Hi, I'm Vika Aronson, podcast producer for the PBS NewsHour. And before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast from one of our promotional partners, Unlocking Bryson's Brain from CBC Podcasts. Unlocking Bryson's Brain is the true story of 13-year-old Bryson, who is a happy, loving boy, but a mysterious disease means he can't walk, talk, or feed himself. After years without a diagnosis, genetic scientists believe they know what's causing Bryson's illness and think it can be reversed. You can join Bryson's family on their search for a medical miracle in Unlocking Bryson's Brain. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, the COVID conflict. Amid a mounting death toll, a whistleblower lays out U.S. missteps as the president breaks with scientists on reopening schools and offers support to protest against lockdowns. Then, leadership in a crisis. Two former White House chiefs of staff from both parties offer lessons learned from their experiences during times of turmoil. Plus, COVID behind bars. The pandemic exposes health care shortcomings of the prison system, now a breeding ground for contagion. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The official global death toll in the COVID-19 pandemic has now reached 300,000. That includes 85,000 in the United States. The new numbers were posted as a federal vaccine expert warned the nation could face, quote, the darkest winter in modern history. White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor begins with this report.
The Subcommittee on Health will now come to order.
Today on Capitol Hill, a top scientist and whistleblower.
Some scientists raised early warning signals that were overlooked, and pages from our pandemic playbook were ignored.
Dr. Rick Bright is a government expert on viruses who was working to combat COVID-19. He alleges that federal officials withheld information in the early months of the coronavirus outbreak.
We did not forewarn people. We did not train people. We did not educate them on social distancing and wearing a mask as we should have in January and February. All of those forewarnings and all those educational opportunities for the American public could have had an impact on further slowing this outbreak and saving more lives.
Bright says he raised concerns about an unproven coronavirus treatment, hydroxychloroquine, touted by President Trump. He also claims, in retaliation, he was pushed out of his job as the director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA. In April, Bright filed a whistleblower complaint. He says his, quote, efforts to prioritize science and safety over political expediency rankled those in the administration who wished to continue to push this false narrative. Last week, the Federal Office of Special Counsel determined Bright's removal was retaliatory. It said he should be reinstated as BARDA's director during the investigation. But the bulk of Bright's warnings today focused on what he frames as the White House's sluggish response to the pandemic. He described warnings from the CEO of a major surgical mask manufacturer, Mike Bowen.
Congressman, I'll never forget the emails I received from Mike Bowen and indicating that our mask supply or N95 respirator supply was completely decimated. And he said, we're in deep shit. The world is, and we need to act. And I pushed that forward to the highest levels I could in HHS and got no response.
We're going to hear about the
committee. Democrats also accused the White House of putting politics before science.
Dr. Bright has filed one of the most specific and troubling whistleblower complaints I've ever seen. He was the right person with the right judgment at the right time. He was not only ignored, he was fired for being right. We can't have a system where the government fires those who get it right and reward those who get it completely wrong.
I believe any whistleblower should be respected.
But Republicans questioned whether Bright himself acted properly. They challenged his motives for testifying.
But this hearing is not about a whistleblower complaint. It's about undermining the administration during a national and global crisis. You chose not to elevate your concerns to the officers of the Inspector General, but instead kept selected screenshots that didn't include full context.
Meanwhile, at the White House, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar echoed critiques of Bright's record and defended President Trump's.
Everything he's complaining about was achieved. Dr. Bright was part of a team and was simply saying what everybody else at the White House and at HHS was saying. Not one bit of difference. And on hydroxychloroquine, Dr. Bright literally signed the application for FDA authorization of it.
President Trump dismissed Bright as bitter.
And he looks like an angry, disgruntled employee who, frankly, according to some people, didn't do a very good job.
The back and forth over Bright came amid the ongoing debate about when and how to reopen the economy. New Labor Department figures showed almost 3 million more Americans filed unemployment claims last week. That brings total claims since the pandemic to more than 36 million. The anxiety is palpable across the country. Today, protesters in Lansing, Michigan, again demanded a reopening. In neighboring Wisconsin on Wednesday, Democratic Governor Tony Evers' stay-at-home order extension was overruled by conservative majority court. Last night, bars quickly filled with patrons not wearing facial coverings against health officials' guidance. One owner, Chad Arndt, said his Port Washington bar employees were desperate to return to work.
After my employees haven't been paid now in 2 months, I had to look out for them and their families, and I had to look out for my business.
Some cities in Wisconsin, including Milwaukee and Madison, quickly imposed their own restrictions after the court ruling. President Trump has encouraged an end to restrictions, and today he traveled again, this time to Allentown, Pennsylvania. There, during a tour of a distribution center that makes personal protective equipment, he ignored his own CDC guidance and did not wear a protective mask. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
Also today, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention posted 6 pages of guidance for reopening schools, businesses, and other groups. The documents had initially been shelved by the White House. Another 57 pages of more extensive guidelines have yet to be released. In the day's other news, tensions between hopes for a recovery and fears of new outbreaks made for another choppy day on Wall Street. But in the end, the market made up some lost ground. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 377 points to close at 23,625. The NASDAQ rose 80 points and the S&P 500 added 32. U.S. Senator Richard Burr stepped aside today as chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee over allegations of insider trading linked to the pandemic. The North Carolina Republican sold large amounts of stock just before the financial markets crashed in February. Burr spoke briefly today outside his Senate office after federal agents seized his phone on Wednesday.
This is a distraction to the hard work of the committee and the members, and I think the security of the country is too important to have a distraction.
Burr says that his stock transactions were based solely on publicly available information. The Senate voted today to reinstate surveillance provisions of the law used in terrorism investigations. Part of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, expired in March. The Senate added new civil liberties protections and sent it back to the House for a final vote. House Democrats are moving ahead with plans to vote tomorrow on a new pandemic relief bill. It totals $3 trillion for aid to state and local governments and more payments to Americans. But this time, Republicans and Democrats are divided, as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made clear today.
It still reads like the Speaker of the House pasted together some random ideas from most liberal members and slapped the word coronavirus on top of it. An unserious product from an unserious House majority that has spent months dealing itself out of the crisis.
Now we're putting our offer on the table. We're open to negotiation, when people say partisan, it's like, wait a minute, it wasn't partisan when they did it. Did you say that? And we're saying, okay, here's our offer. Let's see where you are.
The Senate is not expected to consider the bill until after Memorial Day. In the Philippines, a powerful typhoon struck the eastern part of the country as the COVID-19 pandemic rages. Thousands of people had to go to crowded shelters despite the lack of social distancing in order to escape heavy rain and winds near 100 miles an hour. The swearing in of Israel's new government was delayed today over infighting for cabinet positions. Instead, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former rival, Benny Gantz, announced that the ceremony will take place on Sunday. They agreed to a power-sharing deal to avoid a fourth election in the last year and a half. And back in this country, a federal appeals court revived a lawsuit charging that President Trump is still profiting from his Washington, D.C. hotel while he's in office. The District of Columbia and the state of Maryland have argued that he is violating the Constitution. The Justice Department and Mr. Trump's personal attorney said that they will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Still to come on the News Hour, two former White House chiefs of staff offer lessons learned from times of turmoil. Colleges across the country grapple with how to continue classes during a pandemic. The coronavirus exposes the healthcare shortcomings of the U.S. prison system, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Governing in a crisis like this current pandemic can define a presidency. We were interested to ask whether history offers any guide to the present.
The President of the United States.
On Monday, surrounded by aides in masks, and as the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 passed 80,000, President Trump declared victory in the battle to ramp up widespread testing.
In every generation, through every challenge and hardship and danger, America has risen to the task. We have met the moment, and we have prevailed.
For many, that echoed another moment in 2003, when President George W. Bush spoke 2 months after launching the war in Iraq.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
That conflict would rage on for nearly 9 more years, ultimately claiming more than 4,400 American lives, hundreds of thousands more Iraqi lives, and fail to produce alleged weapons of mass destruction. President Bush faced major crises early in each of his 2 terms. The attacks of September 11, 2001, came just 8 months into his presidency and killed nearly 3,000 Americans. Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in the summer of 2005, killing over 1,800 Americans and displacing hundreds of thousands more. And then in 2008, the housing bubble burst.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
The fallout quickly became President Obama's problem as financial markets seized up. Major U.S. industries like automakers teetered on the brink of collapse, and millions of Americans lost their jobs.
A failure to act will only deepen this crisis, as well as the pain felt by millions of Americans.
2010's Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico was the largest in history.
The United States condemns in the strongest terms this outrageous and shocking attack.
2 years later came the attacks on a U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. And at home, when a gunman killed 20 children and 6 adults at Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary School. And in 2014, intense protests erupted over the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Joining us now are 2 key figures previous presidents have relied on during times of national emergency. Andrew Card served as chief of staff to President George W. Bush, and he helped to lead the administration's response after 9/11. He's now chair of the National Endowment for Democracy, a nonprofit organization in Washington. And former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He served as President Obama's first chief of staff at the height of the Great Recession. Welcome to both of you. It's so good to see you. Let me ask you first, is there really any way to prepare for a crisis like this one, a pandemic? Rahm Emanuel, I mean, you didn't face anything quite like this, did you?
Well, not like this, but we faced multitude. The difference is this is a singular crisis. We faced a crisis of a Great Recession, two of the longest wars in American history, an auto industry and a manufacturing base that was going to collapse, and a financial sector that had totally contracted. So it was a multiple series of dominoes that were crises across the board, rather than one public health crisis instigating and causing an economic contraction of unseen proportions, far greater, obviously, than what we faced on the eve of 2009.
Well, you're right. It was a lot. And Andy Card, you dealt with a lot, not only under...
I used to be 6'2 and 250 pounds.
Go ahead, Andy.
You know, every president has to deal with something that they didn't want to have to deal with. George W. Bush had a number of challenges. Obviously, 9/11 was the biggest one, in addition to the Great Recession that started under his watch. But this is kind of a unique challenge for the United States, but it isn't as if somebody didn't tell us that it could happen. George W. Bush gave a speech at the United Nations in September of 2005 where he called for the world to be prepared for a pandemic. I don't know when it's going to come, but it's going to come. And then he followed up with a major speech in November. It was actually November 1st, 2005, where he challenged America to get ready to deal with a pandemic. And he said, we don't have one going on now, but we have to be prepared for doing it. He called for Congress to appropriate $7.1 billion to get ready for a pandemic. He said, you don't know when it's going to hit, but it's likely to hit. And that was a wonderful roadmap to deal with the challenges that we have today.
And given that, Rahm Emanuel, what has this president done right and what has he done wrong?
Well, look, I do think that the order they put out about what are the metrics for kind of starting to open up society and the economy were the right metrics. I don't think what you would do the day you put them out, put out a tweet, say, liberate Michigan, liberate Minnesota, Virginia, and undermine the very premises of there. I don't think they've done, and I think one of the things the president should be doing, one is this should be a time where you actually aspire towards malice towards none, charity towards all, rather than the inverse, which is malice towards all and charity towards none. I don't think he's brought the country united. And I actually think one of the great silver linings here is that the United States has discovered how much we actually all have our sense of community and neighbor. And a lot of times we talk about our divisions. I actually would say there's the highlight here is the unity and togetherness that there, and the president should aspire towards that. The second thing is rather than not just dividing, I think the biggest loss and the biggest problem was rather than in what every pandemic, every crisis shows, deal with it fast and furious, we have been slow and sloppy. Those first 9 weeks were a crucial 9 weeks. Rather than denying what was going to be a serious problem, rather than deferring, ignoring, even with intelligence and public health warnings, that 9 weeks was a costly 9 weeks.
So, Andy, what about these points that when it comes to building community and, frankly, when it comes to speed, this administration could have done a lot better?
Well, the president did a good job of calling us all to attention. We came to attention. I think it was a little bit tardy. And I don't fault the president because I actually think that he was on it pretty quickly by stopping people from coming in from China. But I think the rest of the administration maybe wasn't really sounding the alarm the way they should have, because it was easy to anticipate that this was likely to happen. And I know some believe that, but I think too many people in the White House maybe weren't heeding the call to action that was coming from CDC and NIH.
And in a situation like that, Rahm, how much of it is the responsibility of the man at the top, the president, and how much of it can be laid on the shoulders of the people who are working for him?
Well, I slightly disagree with Andy. I mean, the intelligence agencies, HHS, were giving the warnings to the White House. I mean, there's a reason Harry S. Truman is famous for the buck stops here, because nobody on the third floor at Health and Human Services can call together the entire government with a sense of urgency like the Oval Office. Andy and I both know, when you're the chief of staff and you pick up the phone and say the president wants, people kind of get focused and real serious. If somebody says the undersecretary of Health and Human Services wants, say, hey, let me put you on hold. I'll get back to you on Tuesday. It's a real difference. And I'm sorry. These first eight weeks, when the president said it would just disappear, and I'm not trying to make a partisan point. Though, when it comes to pandemic or crisis, Andy and I both know what you do in those first 9 weeks or first 8 weeks or first 6 weeks is crucial, and the slow and sloppy start is a costly for lives and for the ability of America to move forward fast. And that has been very costly to the United States. And the president owns
that. What about that, Andy Card?
The president does own it, and I understand that. But I also feel that maybe the other people at the White House, I'm not talking about the agencies. I know the intelligence community was sounding an alarm. But I think too many people maybe at the White House were not saying that this was a serious thing. Peter Navarro evidently knew it. I'm not sure how often he was saying it inside the White House.
I just want to finally come back to both of you on this point that Rahm touched on earlier, and that is the role of the president in inspiring the country and bringing the country together. When you think back to whether it's FDR in World War II or Ronald Reagan after the Challenger disaster, Rahm Emanuel, what criteria should we use in judging a president in that regard at a moment like this?
Well, it's part of the presidential responsibility to give, as the singular office, a voice to the country. And I do think we're united and ready to move forward, and he can marshal that resources. President spoke for all of us, President Bush, on the ashes of 9/11 at the World Trade Center when he says they will hear our voices. President Clinton in Oklahoma, when we saw the first domestic terrorism, at the ceremony there, he said, we will be by your side as many tomorrows as it takes. President Obama in South Carolina spoke, and when he sang Amazing Grace, he touched a chord of our humanity. And I think what is missing here, given the sense of unity that really exists, that the president could actually take it to another level. And I think the reason governors are doing so well is because they see somebody that's trying to bring us together and move forward. And remember, President Kennedy once said, to govern is to choose between bad and worse. And the president in this case, in my view, is squandering a unique opportunity to bring the country together with a singularity of both spirit and mission. And I think that's what I think is essential for the president. And I think he's actually falling short, which is why the public is judging him this way.
Andy Card, finally, what about President Trump on this question of inspiration?
Well, he has not been inspirational. He does have a tendency to listen to more to rosy scenario as an advisor than the reality that, you know, America is strong. The people are reacting. Governors and individuals are making a big difference to help, you know, bring this curve down so that it doesn't overwhelm our healthcare system, and pay attention to what the scientists are telling us to do, to self-distance and be very careful. But President Bush was right when he most recently said, a pandemic doesn't know a Republican or a Democrat. It's there for everybody. This is not a war against anyone. This is a battle against a disease that is all-consuming, and we've got to be all in it together. So don't divide, bring together. We can get through this, but we have to do it together. And I wish the president, the current president, would offer that invitation more so that we could all say, this is our battle. We're all in it together.
Rahm Emanuel, Andy Card, two people who have been there at the White House in moments of crisis. We thank you both.
Thank you, Judy.
The coronavirus pandemic has turned life as we know it upside down.
We're in the United States of America, and you think to yourself, how in the hell did we let this happen?
How are our communities, our jobs, and our daily lives changing? And where do we go from here?
We've spent billions of dollars hunting down terrorist cells. We don't do that with pandemics. That's the wrong approach.
America Interrupted, a new original podcast series from the PBS NewsHour, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Colleges and universities across the country are wrestling with how and when to reopen for classes in the fall. Many are planning to bring students and faculty back to campus for classes. But not all schools believe it is wise for students to return, and some may include a mix of online learning. The California State University System, the largest four-year public university in the country, announced that it plans to offer primarily online remote classes this fall, with only a few exceptions. Timothy White is the chancellor, and he joins me now. Chancellor White, thank you so much for talking with us. So for your, almost 500,000 students and 50,000 faculty and staff, What is this fall going to look like for them?
Well, Judy, nice to join you. And of course, the health and well-being of our students, but our faculty and staff, and also the communities where our 23 campuses are located across the state of California. It's almost 800 miles from the northernmost campus in Humboldt to San Diego State in the south. So, but we think this is in our best interest for our students, allowing them to make progress to their degree, which is so vitally important for them individually and for the state of California, but also doing it in the COVID-19 era that will sadly persist over the next academic year. And so this is precisely the moment for students to lean into their education, and we want to create as many options for as many students as is humanly possible. And that's why we've decided to, in the fall, to be prepared to be as 100% virtual as you can be. There's some courses that you could never do, some of the laboratory courses or hands-on experiments in engineering or architecture or agriculture, things of that nature. But we want to be prepared for that, the worst case scenario, so that hopefully things be better in some parts of the state and we can actually do a little bit more in person.
Right. So there will be some exceptions, as you say, for labs, and you mentioned architecture. I'm curious to know what percentage of your classes before now were being taught online?
We were about 10% of our courses online before, and when we pivoted 2 months ago in March to be online to finish out this academic term here in the spring of 2020, we converted 72,000 courses from in-person to online in the course of about a week and a half. Quite a monumental undertaking by our faculty and by our students and staff.
And that's what I wanted to ask you. How much of your faculty has had experience with this? Because it is a change.
It is a change, and that's the reason we're announcing now, is so our faculty over the summer months can prepare. You know, they're brilliant when it comes to their content area, whether it's in biochemistry or physics or business or whatever the case may be. But some have experience with technology, virtual technology-assisted learning, and others have not. They've been more of a traditional faculty member over the years. So we're actually creating summer institutes across the system where faculty can virtually come in for an intensive, immersive experience to learn how to use all this amazing new technology that's developing on a daily basis to create that same vibrant, engaged learning experience in the fall in the virtual space rather than in the physical space.
So with most people then being from home, is your tuition going to go down? Are costs going to go down?
No, the cost of delivery through virtual technology actually increases with the purchasing of hardware, software, firmware, and the training of faculty. And tuition, of course, only pays a portion of what it costs to educate a student. The other part comes from the state of California. So we're clear on keeping our tuition and mandatory fees constant because our costs that support delivering the education through a virtual means remains.
But how do you make the case to your students, though, that an online education is every bit as valuable as an in-person education?
Well, you know, that's the adaptation to the moment of this COVID era. We have to find a way to make sure that our students, and I will tell you, it'll be different in the fall, but it'll be very, very good. And not only the faculty teaching, but also very robust virtual academic support and student support. So in the virtual space, it'll be as robust as we humanly can. We will have on campus laboratories, for example, capstone for seniors that are graduating. But instead of having 20 students in a lab, there'll be something like 5 students in a lab, and they'll be physically distanced. And in between use of the instrumentation, there will be cleaning of the instrumentation, and people will have on personal protective gear. So we believe very strongly it's time for our students, new ones, and continuing to lean in and to get that all-important degree, because that can never be taken away from them in any given moment in time. If you have a college degree, your unemployment rate is about half of what the rest of the population is, and income is about $1 million more over your lifetime. So it's not a time to stop, even though there are some inconveniences. It's a way to adapt and cope and keep moving forward.
You've said that you are open, though, to reinstating classes if you get different news. What experts are you listening to for that kind of information?
We're using science, following the data. We're using international epidemiologists and also local epidemiologists here in the state of California. We have infectious disease practitioners that are advising us. And, of course, our regional and local public health officials, as well as state public health officials. And so since the health and well-being is at the top of the list, it's going to be that advice, that forecasting that guides us to this. And quite frankly, is one of the main reasons why we have decided to do what we're doing.
Chancellor Timothy White, California State University System, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. Bye-bye.
COVID-19 is sweeping through the country's jails and prisons. They have proven to be a breeding ground for contagion, with tight quarters that don't allow room for social distancing, for shortages of cleaning supplies, and lack of protective gear like masks. Some prison systems and jails have been releasing inmates early to free up space. But people we spoke to inside say it is too little, too late. Tonight, we are launching a new series of reports on criminal justice reform. We are calling it Searching for Justice. In a moment, William Brangham will talk with the former medical director of New York's prisons. But first, Yamiche Alcindor brings us some voices from prisoners and their families.
There have been dozens of cases of COVID-19 inside the District of Columbia jail.
He tells me that people catch it like it's water.
The situation became so dire that in April, a federal judge ordered an emergency overhaul of the jail's health measures. Sakeithia Staley's partner, William Cox, is being held in the D.C. jail on a weapons possessions charge.
People have corona. Instead of them, sending people home or, sending people to the doctors, all they're doing is quarantining them in the cell for a long period of time. And that's not safe because the cells are dirty. People have died from it in the same units, in the same floors that he's on. He feel like that it's easy for him to get it.
Right now, more than 2 million Americans are sitting behind bars as the coronavirus outbreak deepens. Many prison systems have ended in-person visiting for loved ones. Inmates say there's little they can do to avoid catching the virus.
Brian Acey is serving a life sentence for kidnapping and rape at San Quentin State Prison. He now directs a media outlet there run by inmates.
It's not really built for 6 feet distance because it's too packed. When they let us out to eat dinner, we still have to stand in line to get our food, and it's still, there's no way we can keep the six feet. If you have symptoms or anything, it's like they punish you because they put you in a hole to quarantine you away from everybody. So if a person is sick, they're going to try to keep it away from them because nobody wants to go to the hole. If something happens, there's nothing that they can do because it's too crowded in here.
California's prison system says they're making use of vacant space to keep inmates 6 feet apart.
You may start the conversation now.
One inmate, who preferred not to use his full name, described the conditions inside the Missouri prison where he's serving time for murder.
Well, we have masks. They just gave us something that they can call a mask, but the staff are not required to wear masks at this time. We keep trying to reason with them, well, we need the staff to wear it because they're the only ones that can bring it in here. We don't get cleaning chemicals for our cells. If you can afford Ajax, the only thing you can clean your cell with is Ajax. My main concern is the ventilation system because they don't have no air blowing out. I cough in my cell, and if it's germs in it, it can go to the next cell or whatever. We all hooked up together. If one person get it, we all got it.
Cami Maturin runs a nonprofit that works with incarcerated people in Louisiana, including her fiancé, Savora Sutton, who is serving a life sentence for second-degree murder.
He has been there for, this is his 29th year. I believe that he had the coronavirus back in March because he had all the symptoms. He had the sinus, the cough, the congestion, he had fever.
She worries prison authorities are resigned to COVID deaths.
When you hear that they've accepted 2,500 body bags and you get a will and testament from your loved one, that is that that's knocks the wind out of you, because I did receive a will via email. So did a couple of other people.
Meanwhile, inmates and their families can do little but wait and hope the virus doesn't find them behind bars. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Michelle Sendor.
To help us better understand how and why this virus is hitting prisons and jails so hard, I am joined now by Dr. Homer Venters. He's the former chief medical officer of the New York City jail system, and he's the author of Life and Death in Rikers Island. Dr. Venters, thank you very much for being here. We heard a lot of concerns in that tape piece by Michelle Sendor about conditions inside the prison. We've heard that there's a lot of outbreaks in there. This may seem very obvious to you, but can you just tell us a little bit more about why jails and prisons are such great vehicles for spreading the virus?
Certainly, and thank you for having me and focusing on this important topic. Jails and prisons and ICE detention centers, they're really created physically in a manner that promotes the spread of communicable disease. And COVID-19, we know, is very easily spread from people, one person to another. And so the close contact that people are in when they're detained, when they're in housing areas or other parts of these facilities, really promotes the spread between both the people who are detained and staff. But two other very important aspects are that the way they're run, these facilities, the way there's a high tolerance for squalor, for filth, where the idea of infection control is really antithetical to what you see inside these places with trash and garbage and lack of attention to keeping the places clean. The operational standards in these places really promote the spread of this disease. And then finally, because we've kept all of our evidence-based health structures and organizations outside of these walls for decades, places like the CDC, State Departments of Health, CMS, and the Joint Commission, things that help us have evidence-based practices in the community, those groups are generally AWOL when it comes to health practices and transparency behind bars. And so we find that implementing evidence-based practices in an emergency like this is very hard to do when we haven't tried to do that before the emergency started.
Knowing who is sick and who is not inside the prison walls is obviously enormously important. That comes back to testing. What can you tell us about the landscape of testing? Is it being done? Is it being done enough in jails and prisons around the country?
No, it certainly is not being done enough. There are many places that continue to have scores of people reporting that they are short of breath, or even people that have objective fevers that are not being tested. So there is not enough testing. But, you know, your point is a really critical one, which is that these places already have broken systems for people who are sick to access any kind of health service. So something that's called sick call in most of these places, where somebody writes down on a piece of paper, my stomach hurts, my head hurts, I can't breathe. Many places that I've investigated, those complaints of real medical problems go completely unanswered. So that's the landscape, that's the baseline. And then you put in COVID-19, where all of a sudden scores of people in these places have new health problems. And there are broken systems at play. Certainly the lack of testing, though, is an important part of this, because when you see, for instance, cases among staff going up, 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 but you see no testing or no positive cases among detained people, you have to wonder what's going on. It's probably not that nobody who's detained actually has the virus.
We've certainly seen certain jails and prison facilities releasing prisoners to try to free up more space. We saw Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, released because he's an older person. How important is releasing prisoners to free up space as far as preventing the spread inside these facilities?
It's a critical tool, and it's one that's being used effectively in many areas, but not enough. It's a critical tool because it allows us to get some of the most vulnerable people out of detention settings, people we know are at high risk for actually dying if they contract COVID-19. It's a critical tool, as you mentioned, because it helps us manage the outbreak inside for everybody who's still there. So we can spread people out, keep people in appropriate housing areas and a safer distance from each other. But it's also a critical tool because it helps us prevent local hospital systems from becoming overwhelmed. When the virus runs like wildfire through these facilities, just in the space of a day or two, it can overwhelm a local hospital. And particularly for rural counties, where we have fewer and fewer hospitals because of hospital closures, but we have lots and lots of county jails, state and federal prisons, and ICE detention centers. When this virus takes hold in crowded facilities, it can completely overwhelm the sole hospital that might be serving one or two counties in the space of a day or two.
All right, Dr. Homer Venters, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Once again, the hemorrhaging of American jobs was in the millions last week. The official unemployment rate is likely to spike to 20% by June, if that is not already the case unofficially. And Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell warns that we could be facing a prolonged recession that could damage growth for years to come. Everyone wants to restart the economy. The question is how. Paul Solman gets the views of a Nobel Prize-winning economist. It's part of our series, Making Sense.
Right now, this week, there is a choice about getting some more activity going versus protecting lives.
Paul Romer, who won a Nobel Prize in 2018 for his work on technology and economic growth. These days, he's focused on how to avoid an economic depression.
Really, the only way to get back to a healthy economy is to stop the death and make people feel safe.
And ending the lockdowns won't do that, he says.
We're going to have a kind of a seesaw pattern, I think, of trying to open up, realize that we haven't done anything to protect against the spread of the virus, and then pulling back. And what we're going to just have to do is find a sustainable way to contain this virus.
That way, he's been arguing, is mass testing. Everyone in the U.S. every 2 weeks.
If you don't know who's infectious, the only way to lock down and isolate the people who are infectious is to lock down everybody. I think if we just test everybody and isolate the people who are infectious, we can easily suppress it, and we can do it without, you know, causing a depression.
But how can we do that, given the well-known shortages of test supplies, personal protective equipment, laboratory capacity? Says Romer, how can we not? Just look at his model.
Each additional unit of testing frees up about 8 or 9 people who can go back to work. What's the value of the work that 8 or 9 people can do? Man, the test is really cheap compared to what the people can do. And for people who say, well, we can't get a lot of them right now, I'm okay with that. Let's just get as many as we can right now and start to get some people back to work.
Economics is fundamentally about costs versus benefits. So all this testing costs how much versus how much is added to the economy when the 9 people that you were talking about go back to work.
If we can get the cost of a test down to $10, so one unit of testing per day will cost us about, you know, $3,600 per year. If that frees up 9 people, then that means at a median income of, say, $50,000, 9 times 50,000 would be $450,000. It's like a 100-fold increase on your investment. There aren't very many investments where you get a 100x return, pretty much guaranteed.
The latest relief bill did include $25 billion for testing.
So is $25 billion enough?
No. We need to commit about $100 billion a year to expenditures on testing. That's enough to get us this 23 million tests per day, or test everybody every 14 days in the United States. The $25 billion is enough to get going. It'll give us some demonstration projects. I think we should be testing and reopen, you know, for TV, Major League Baseball. I think we should be testing everybody in nursing homes. I think we should be testing frequently everybody who's a healthcare provider.
Are you condemning the country for not having had the tests?
No. Bygones are bygones. I think it's a horrible mistake to worry about, you know, who do we blame, who are we going to punish, or to be thinking about, oh, woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Romer does, however, fault the Food and Drug Administration.
The FDA application was 28 pages long.
Miles O'Brien's recent Frontline documentary described the challenges faced by a University of Washington researcher in the early days of the pandemic. when he raced to get a new test approved.
One of the things is they needed a document FedExed across the country before they could look at the document.
You couldn't electronically transmit it.
I could electronically transmit it, but they couldn't look at it until it was FedExed.
The FDA told me it did review Greninger's application, but it was incomplete. They also said they were balancing the need for tests with concerns about accuracy.
I understand why they have to be very careful, but they're making people who are innovating, finding better ways to do the tests, jump through these extraordinary hoops, and it's taking months to just get simple things done.
Case in point, says Romer, the saliva test approved last week.
You spit in the tube. Much better than those swabs.
I'm sorry, but I have to get in there, okay?
But it took almost a month for the FDA to say, okay, well, somebody can spit in the tube without being physically present in front of a healthcare professional who watches them while they do it.
Right.
I mean, if it takes a month to make a decision like that, we're never going to get to the faster, cheaper, better test that we need.
What about people who've gotten the blood test that shows that they have antibodies, so they must have had the virus? Are they then okay to just go back into the world?
So you can't restart an economy with just the 5% who've got antibodies. You've got to let the virus run through the community and get to 60, 70% with antibodies. But it's a horrific path to get there because a million people are going to die along the way, and it'll take a year for that kind of process to work through the whole economy.
What's your biggest fear right now, economically?
The biggest risk we face is that the economic turmoil is going to lead to political turmoil. We can rebuild, we can recover income, but if we damage our institutions of rule of law, of democracy, of basic freedoms, that can take a lot longer to rebuild.
Are we moving towards the kind of investment you think we have to make?
I am actually very confident that it's going to happen because there are no good alternatives. We're losing $500 billion a month. It's eventually going to dawn on people that we can't afford to keep doing that. And compared to that, $100 billion a year is really pretty cheap.
In fact, Romer is sure enough that testing will soon be everywhere. He offered to put his money where his heart is. $500 of it.
I'm so confident that testing will be the way out of this crisis that I'll bet you that in 6 months, we'll be doing 20 million tests a day in the United States.
So I'm betting against you now that we're not going to hit 20 million a day tests in 6 months.
Yep.
And I pay your charity if you win and you pay my charity.
That's a deal.
I'll take that bet.
Okay. Have me back and we'll see how it goes.
For the PBS NewsHour, the ever-skeptical Paul Salmon, now with some skin in the game.
And that brings us to Ask Us, where we take your questions on the pandemic to experts to help make sense of these tough times. We get your questions from our website, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And for the record, Facebook is a funder of the NewsHour. Amna Nawaz has more.
Thanks, Judy, and thanks to all of you for sending us your questions. Now, parents and grandparents are dealing with even more responsibilities these days, taking on new roles as teachers and counselors, in addition to caregivers. A lot of you sent us questions about parenting in the pandemic. To answer them, we're joined by Dr. Sarah Vinson, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. She's also the former president of the Georgia Council on Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and she joins us now from Atlanta. Dr. Vinson, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's jump right into the questions now. Our very first one comes from Ann Stringer. She's a grandmother from Mays Landing, New Jersey. She reached out to on Facebook, and this is Ann's question. She says, I feel anxious and closed off with my adult girls back home. Also, my son is overwhelmed with his three kids. Any tips for our multi-generational family? Dr. Vinson, what advice can you give Ann?
So the advice I give in is going to be similar to the advice I'm giving everyone right now, is to focus on the things that you have control over and that you can change. And so we can't change the fact that people are sort of cooped up or that your family have a lot of extra responsibilities right now, but we can still be intentional about making connections with people and talking and interacting in whatever ways make the most sense for us. So that can look like playing board games electronically, doing FaceTime, just calling to catch up, or just looking for ways to be active and involved in your grandchildren's lives and being another touch point for them in a positive way.
Those are all great tips. Good luck to Anne out there. Let's go to our next question now. It comes from Julie Guerin. She's in Napa, California. She also reached out on Facebook, and Julie sent us this video.
Some parents are beginning to let their kids socialize. How can I keep my kids safe and still let them connect with friends in person? I'm making sure that my kids wash their hands and I'm monitoring their proximity to others, but other parents may not be.
Dr. Vincent, how do you do that? How do you keep your own kids safe and can you still let them safely socialize with other kids?
So like anything else when it comes to parenting, there's sort of a risk-benefit analysis that you do, right? When your child is learning to drive, you're afraid of letting them do that, but you know it's sort of part of what they need to do in order to progress. And so now we're in post-COVID world or COVID world where part of parenting is thinking about these things. And so just like if you were going to have your kids go over for a party at someone's house or a play date, you may ask questions about, are the parents going to be there? What's the level of supervision? Those sorts of things. You get more information so that you can make a decision as a parent about if this is safe enough for me to feel comfortable with them going. So under these conditions, I think it's completely fine for you to ask questions about whether their friend has been sheltering in place, what precautions they have taken, if people are going to be wearing masks when they're getting together. And those are all pieces of information you have a right to as a parent. And using that information, you can then make a decision about whether it makes sense to move forward with that in-person play date or not. I do think that that is going to be really helpful for children from a mental health standpoint to be able to talk and interact with their friends. And so there are ways that we can make this safer if everybody's wearing masks, if we're asking those questions, and those sorts of things.
The risk-benefit analysis of parenting we all know so well. Let's go on to another question now. This is from L.H. Phillips. She works in education in Arkansas. She submitted this question to us on Facebook. She writes, quote, "We were thrust into this situation with little preparation. What will we do with students who are poorly prepared when schools reopen?" Dr. Vincent, it's such a good question. What can you say to L.H.?
This transition back is going to be a challenge for teachers, for administrators, for parents, and especially for the children. And I do think there are ways that we're going to see pre-existing gaps in education that get bigger as a result of people being home for so long. And so the next question is, well, what do we do? And I think that there is time now for us to have conversations with school districts, with administrators, with state decision makers around the kinds of supports that we need to have in place for kids, both from an academic standpoint and an emotional standpoint, when they go back to school, to give them a better chance at this being a successful transition.
So important to point out the problems existed before will still be there post-pandemic. Our final question now comes to us from Holly Joseph. She's in the Bay Area in California. She reached out to us on Twitter, and Holly sent us this video.
How do we keep kids engaged in distance learning versus just completing their assigned tasks?
Dr. Vincent, Holly is in my husband Paul and my heads. How do we do this? This is so difficult for so many parents homeschooling right now.
Parents are being asked to do something that is a skilled profession. And so my advice is look for ways that it applies, that makes sense for you and that makes sense for the child, and that you can demonstrate sort of in the home setting. So it could be something like playing Monopoly together if you're talking about money and making change. So looking for things that use those principles that they're using in school, but in a practical way where you're able to engage with them. Looking for ways that you can incorporate that into activities that you do as a family.
Good luck to all the parents out there. Dr. Sarah Vincent, thank you so much for being with us and taking these questions today.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for your questions. You can send us more anytime via NewsHour's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts or on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour.
And online, we have more tips for parents on talking to children about the virus and their feelings. That, too, is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.